afternoon. Father. Right, turning the mic on. Sorry, I was just getting an experiment set up for at the end of the class, which I thought I had hidden, but I think probably just showed you, so I probably just completely blew it, but we'll see when we get there. Some of you at least weren't looking. Bringing things together, we're going to start looking at reading. This week is going to be mostly about trying to bring the language and vision strands of the course together. And in particular, what I want to talk about today is a number of different aspects of reading. It's worth some sort of general reflection on the status of written language before we start doing this, just to get our heads in the right place and to sort of set some expectations. Because there's a very important difference between spoken and written language, which I'm sure you're all aware of, but I want to emphasize it because I want to emphasize the significance, I want to draw out the significance of the difference. Human spoken language at a reasonable degree of complexity is at least 100,000 years old. That's a sort of consensus minimum estimate for something that we might recognize something that has most of what we've got today. There's an enormous amount of debate about this and a dearth of hard evidence, but there are certainly people who make a case for it being even twice as old as that. And exactly where in that interval, I don't think we'll ever know with any degree of certainty, barring the invention of time machines, which not looking forward to in my lifetime anyway. Because the crucial point for my purposes at any rate is that we're like two orders of magnitude less than that when we look at written language. In some form or other, we start getting something like pictographic systems at most 6,000 years ago in Egypt or Mesopotamia, and the archaeologists have a needle match going as to which one of them can find the oldest example of real pictographic language in the two different regions, Mesopotamia, that being Iraq, Iran, the sort of Persian basin there. And then we get pictograms arising in the Indus and further east in subsequent millennia. And we even get some kind of non-pictorial, something approximating an alphabetic or a syllabic form as recently as 4,000 years ago, or as far long ago as 4,000 years ago, depending on, I suppose, on how you look at it. But crucially, 4,000 years is really not enough to expect any significant amount of biological specialization, right? Genetics, natural selection, can work surprisingly fast in certain small areas. There are claims that the gene for lactase, the enzyme that you need to metabolize the lactose, the protein in cow's milk, actually spread, was single point of origin and spread within a small number of thousands of years throughout the cradle of civilization, farming civilization population. I have no idea where the basis for that kind of claim comes from. Even if it's true, the immediate physical impact of something like that on the development of a farming-based human population is going to drive selective pressure hugely more rapidly than the ability of a handful of people to read is going to drive natural selection in the population as a whole. So I think it's plausible to say that we have minimal, if any, adaptation at present at the level of our genetically determined biological selves for reading or writing, because they're just too new, right? And whether we will in due course or not is an interesting question. Right? But the bottom line is, like so much else of cognition, there's a huge literature, and it's fascinating, about the extent to which the overall cognitive mechanisms are old and repurposed, or new and built for the purpose. And there's a lot of discussion about that, and I'm not qualified to even introduce it to you except to say it's out there. Right? And the fact of the matter is, there's certainly evidence that even synchronically, even in individuals, we can repurpose brain material. Right? The question of what kinds of strokes and physical accidents we can recover from and which ones we can't is a huge and complicated discussion, but there's certainly evidence that we do it. Right? People who have bits of their head blown off recover in ways that the simple locality theories that I've been telling you about can't account for. So the possibility of repurposing is definitely there, and over time, over generations, over evolutionary time, the fact that bits of the old mammal brain and the old primate brain and the new hominid brain have been repurposed electrochemically, right, and to a certain extent morphologically, that evidence is pretty strong. But at the moment, at least, we have to say that as far as reading and writing are concerned, these have to piggyback on mechanisms, on physiology at least, that we already have, because we haven't had time to build it from scratch. There's another question, which I'm not going to talk about any further than to mention it, except that it's fun. So it deserves mention, right? Which is that when we think of reading, we primarily think of the kind of reading that we do when we're sitting in front of a computer screen or when we're reading a book. And that's silent reading. But silent reading is new. Some of you may know this. It's the kind of thing about which anecdotes circulate, right? There are more or less well-attested anecdotes which identify different famous historical figures as the first or an early or an astonishing to all his or her contemporaries person who could read without speaking out loud. Right? Be interested to know who's heard which of these, if any. The one that I first heard was Julius Caesar. I heard it claimed that Caesar, I don't know where or when, somebody told me that Caesar was the first person to read silently, right? That he was seen reading a letter from his wife in the Senate. And people didn't know how he could do this because he wasn't interrupting the debate. He was reading the letter without speaking. Alexander the Great appears in the relevant Wikipedia article. I hadn't heard that one before. Augustine tells a lengthy story about St. Augustine tells a lengthy story about the first time he went to visit Ambrose in Rome in 360-odd AD and discovered that despite having, having stood outside his door for a while because he was scared to meet the great man, eventually knocks on the door and goes in and discovers that Ambrose has been reading the Bible. But he didn't hear anything through the door, and this astonished him. Never seen that before. Right? So, in general, the feeling is that aside from these kind of exceptional people about whom stories are told, widespread silent reading didn't really arise until about 1,000 years ago, as reading began to spread outside a tiny fraction. I mean, realizing just how few people could read. Well up into the Middle Ages. Think about the interaction between the availability of the printing press and the distribution of printed material and the utility of being able to read and so on and so forth. There's a huge and complicated history here. There's a pointer in the on the webpage to a lovely book if you're interested in this sort of thing. And indeed, there's a reasonable amount of evidence that most, allegedly all, people still subvocalize. That is, that if you put electrodes in the relevant places, you will detect that the muscles that drive your tongue and your jaw and your vocal cords are getting nerve signals. They're just subcritical. They're not enough to actually get phonation going or to get your tongue moving. It's unclear just how widespread or how much that can be suppressed with practice. Of course, we're not aware of it. So reading is new. Reading is a skill that's only relatively recently spread throughout the population. And silent reading is even newer. But an awful lot of psycholinguistic investigation has been done about what you will, if you will, the first phase of reading, reading aloud, actually saying what you see. And indeed, of course, because this is psycholinguistics, and the simpler material you can work with, the more reliable your results tend to be. An awful lot of this work is about single words, or indeed single non-words, strings of letters which don't actually make up words. Those of you who are taking Psych 1 have probably already encountered this. Hands up? Yes? No? Reading? A little bit? Maybe? Word, non-word distinctions? One or two of you think you remember this? Never mind. I'll say a little bit about it. It does seem, at least for English speakers, poor benighted English speakers, that there must exist two kinds of relevant knowledge. And this observation goes back several hundred years. Didn't need psychologists to tell us this. That there's some kind of word-centered knowledge and also some kind of letter-centered knowledge. Right, that these two things are separate. And indeed, we mentioned this a few weeks ago when I talked briefly about letter-to-sound rules and the fact that some aphasics can't say yacht, but they can say banana, right? And vice versa. Right? There's a double dissociation there. And informally, this idea has a very long history. But it was rendered explicit and experimentally testable most recently and most notably, not most recently, but sort of primarily in the 20th century in the sort of modern overall psycholinguistic consensus by Max Coulthart in a computational model, very familiar in its outline to the kind of thing that we've been looking at with Pinker. It's called the Dual Root Cascade Model, or DRC for short. It looks like that. I don't know if you can read the labels, but I'll tell you what they say. Up at the top, we have print, and down at the bottom, we have speech, and in between, we have two roots, dual root, right? At one level, we see the letters, that's orthographic analysis, and we maybe have an orthographic lexicon, a collection of strings that give access, on the one hand, to a semantic system, to the words and concepts of the in the ways that we talked about, for instance, that are involved in semantic priming. On the other hand, the orthographic input lexicon maps, may map more or less directly on Coulthart's account, to an output lexicon. So we know about the words that we know not only what they look like and what they mean, but also what they sound like. And it's that root which Coulthart would say is involved in our ability to see Y-A-C-H-T on the screen and say yacht. Right? Then we go from the word as a whole to the pronunciation as a whole, and that this then is mediated through a response buffer to actually get out through the articulators. Alternatively, from the orthographic analysis, we may go straight to letter or letter pair grapheme to phoneme rules. right? Letter to sound rules, as I called them the other day, which get to the response buffer by a separate route, thus the dual route story. How Cascade comes into it, you'll have to read one of the papers to find out. Because guess what? This is, if you see the parallel, very much a dual mechanism theory in a way not very dissimilar to the one that we saw from Pinker for the past tense. That we have some kind of whole word-based story, and we have some kind of rule-based story. So at that level, at the level of the modules, if you will, this is a two-mechanism theory. But more recently, and there's rules and there's memory. There's that level of mechanism as well. Whereas more recently, we have an associationist model that's been proposed, a single mechanism model called the triangle model from Seidenberg and McClellan. Remember McClellan, same guy, right? What's interesting about this is it's more obvious as it eventually became obvious when we looked into the details of what Pinker and Prince ended up with, that at the level of the modules, there's not that much difference between these two theories, right? There's still two ways through this story, right? That you can either, it's just that the sort of the way this thing is structured as a picture isn't the same. That on this account, right, there's either a way to get from the orthography to the phonology, from the writing to the sound directly, right? This is the equivalent of this, right? Or via meaning. And there's an additional claim here, which is implicit here, but explicit here, that things like, if you will, priming are going to only occur insofar as context is involved. Right? Because context feeds in via meaning. And so it's this route that will get facilitated by contextual effects, you might suppose. Right? This story, this picture doesn't carry with it so obviously an account of facilitation in priming. But there is priming, right? Not only as we saw, as we discussed, for word, non-word decision tasks, but also for simply say the word you see, right? You will say it faster if it's related, or indeed if you've seen it, if you've seen it or a word that's semantically related to it recently. Right, you'll get the word, you'll get the sound out faster. Right? So at the modularity level, there's not much difference here, but this is not, at least not explicitly, and not at the first level of description, a neural based on an associationist model. Right, the grapheme to phoneme rule system looks like any other linguistic rule system. It assumes that you've got something like a production system with discrete patterns that match or don't match completely, and a priority system, and all the rest of that gubbins that you need to drive a little pattern action rule system. And it doesn't immediately, at least, suggest an associationist model. Whereas in the triangle model, there really is only one mechanism. It's just that the mechanism is connected in a complicated way, so there's more than one way through it. And it would be interesting to see whether a story like this, I'm sure somebody has constructed a story which is at least topologically like this to play the past tense game in an associationist way. So sort of dual mechanism versus single mechanism, symbolic versus connectionist. This bit is quite clearly symbolic. Sound familiar, right? We've just been talking about that. There's a huge literature about this, right? We've talked about the way in which normal science proceeds by the exploration of a particular paradigm, a way of thinking about a problem. Even though these two theories compete with one another, they compete with one another in a sort of consensus arena. And there's an enormous literature, which it's, you know, a challenge to get into here, you know, 15 years, or actually, Coulthard is 89, so where are we? You know, 24 or 25 years since the original publication of the DRC proposal, and then McClellan and Seidenberg come along about 6 years later. I think I'm getting the dates wrong. Doesn't matter, right? There's at least 20 years of this stuff. And if you go and read a paper that's published on this stuff today, it assumes you know the whole history. And it's situated in the context of the whole history. It's trying to address a remaining corner case of, you know, trying to squeeze just a little more out of the difference, or to make a bit more of the difference between the two at this late stage. Not surprisingly, if you read a paper by Coulthard, and there's a pointer from the webpage, he's got a nice summary, and it ends up by saying the DRC approach has got the, you know, the majority of the points scored as opposed to the associationist approach. And if you go on and read Plaut's summary of the associationist approach, he finishes off by saying, we're clearly doing much better than poor Max is. And I leave it to you to figure out what you think is actually true. One of the interesting observations, of course, is that the more recent fMRI and metabolic brain data that we're getting it's much harder to make an argument between the two, because at the level of modularity, these two are pretty similar. And insofar as what the brain data that we'll talk about more by the end of the week can tell you, it's about modules. It's not about individual concepts or individual connections by and large. And you won't be surprised that our old friend operationalization keeps coming back, because the question of what aspects of these models are meant to be parts that they're held accountable for, which correspond to what physiological or metabolic phenomena, when we get to fMRI or the metabolic measures, that's a crucial sort of battleground as people argue back and forth about. It's also relevant that both of these theories make demands on theories of memory in ways that should be, I hope, obvious to you from the discussions that you had last week about the different memories, you know, the overall sort of functional decomposition that people are suggesting with respect to the way our memory system operates. And of course, one of the ways in which that's true is that we've got in these stories both modality-specific memories, memories for visual phenomena, memories for acoustic phenomena. In the case of the limited amount of work that's been done with blind patients, that is blind aphasics, for instance, it's a small population, a small percentage of a small population already, but it does exist, right? We get the tactile modality for braille reading, and the more abstract modality independent kinds of memory, semantic memory, episodic memory, and so on, right? It should be clear that those both, you know, there were parts of that, those two pictures, which drew on one or the other of those components of any memory model. Aphasias, well, I've already really mentioned this, but I wanted to get something up about Japanese, because it's a unique language with respect to the opportunity that it gives us to look for double dissociation. Because we get a double dissociation between the two different kinds of writing systems. Japanese is written in two completely different ways, one of which is very familiar to us, even though the particular graphemes aren't. It's an alphabetic system or a syllabic system in which there are about 45 symbols for the 45 different possible syllables of Japanese. It has a simpler syllable structure than English does, so they can get away with that. On the other hand, they've got ideograms, borrowed from Chinese, in which there's a one-to-one correspondence between an ideogram or a pair, or in rare cases, a triple of ideograms, and a whole word. There's no phonological relationship. There's just a physical appearance to whole word correlation. And we see just what you would expect from the modularity of the stories we were just looking at in terms of double dissociation. So whereas these are examples of kanji, right? I don't know, any Japanese speakers in the room? Good, you can correct me if I get it wrong, right? So this is the kanji for Yamada sensei. This is the kana, Yamada sensei, right? Means, well, at one level, that means mountain, and that means rice paddy. But actually, and they have different pronunciations. But taken together, it's one word, it's a person's name, Yamada. Sensei is teacher, right? So this is a sort of, I don't know, you could gloss this as Prof. Yamada, right? It's the honorific, polite way of referring to a teacher whose surname is Yamada. On the other hand, this is Ichousa, where this is E, meaning necessary or lacking, and it's a single word. The pronunciation is very simple in this case. And Chousa is a two-ideogram word. The pronunciation's not the same as the pronunciation of these ideograms separately, and it means research, right? So this ideogram is sort of an ideogram that you put on something at the end of every paper. It says more work is needed in this area, right? Well, this ideogram, this pair of ideograms occurs a great deal in Japanese scientific papers for that reason. Okay? But what we find in Japanese aphasic patients is exactly the double dissociation you would expect if there are what amount to kana to sound rules, just like there are letter to sound rules for English, on the one hand, which allow you to sound it out, because that's the only way I can do this. My Japanese is pretty modest, so I can look at this and say, Yamada, 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 right, sensei, right, okay, I got that, right? Or this one's harder, or alternatively, to just look at the pair of kanji and say, Yamada, sensei, right, at the whole word level. It's sort of more obvious that it's done at the whole word level when you've got ideograms. Although what you find in English speakers is a pattern where people are very good at words like post office and stop and yield because they see them all the time. And sometimes you'll find an aphasic who can only recognize the word stop when it's in the right font. Right, when it looks like a stop sign. Japanese patients who can read the kanji, but not the same word when it's written in kana. Or who can read the kana, but can't read the same word when it's written in kanji. And you actually get what's somewhat astonishingly is some kind of four-way dissociation, where reading and writing are distinguished as well, right? And where exactly how many cells in the multidimensional space that gives up are populated by actual patients, I don't know. I haven't read the Japanese aphasia literature in any detail. But that's just a reminder that whenever you have any theory which has any kind of modular structure, people will go off and look for double dissociations, either in the aphasiology literature or, more recently, in the brain scan data. Moving on, because I do want to get to this experiment before the end and I'm running out of time. From looking at single words to more continuous material, silent reading, we have to enlist much more of what we know about the human visual system. So my colleague Richard Shilcock, who works on reading full time, has this wonderful sort of dictum, which he tends to use in his lectures about reading. Words reinvent the functional architecture of visual cognition and increase the importance of even peripheral aspects of the anatomy of the visual system. On Thursday, when Frank Keller comes to visit and talks to us about eye tracking and reading, we'll see just a little bit of that, that it turns out that what appear to be almost accidental or even maladapted aspects of the visual system, which are, in particular, that we don't actually focus very well at very close distances, right? That actually getting the focal point of the two eyes right on the same spot when it's within a few, you know, tens of centimeters, we don't actually manage it. We're a couple of millimeters out, which makes almost no difference at all when I'm looking at you. But it actually makes a beneficial difference when I'm looking at the screen or when I'm looking at a book, for reasons that Frank will probably get onto on Thursday. So the cognitive novelty, this is why I mentioned this whole business about the history of reading being so short, right? The novelty of this problem means that we've recruited all kinds of little corners of the visual system to enable us to do it at all, right? That we've pulled together, cobbled it together out of spare parts, quite literally, right? Because with respect to the task of reading, there aren't any purpose-built parts already available. So we had to do it with spare parts. Most of what you know about reading is wrong. Just as our subjective experience of speech recognition is wrong, right? We think we hear a sequence of discrete words. That's what you hear me to be saying. You could write them down, right? But there's actually very little silence in fluent speech. At the end of pause, at the end of phrases, yes, but between words, in the middle of phrases, absolutely not. You may think there are, but they're not there. If you put a microphone in front of me, if you took this microphone and you fed it into an old-fashioned oscilloscope and you looked at the time amplitude waveform, in the whole of the last 3 or 4 seconds before now, there wouldn't be any silence at all. What there is in the middle of, and those other stops, T and D and, not D, T and K and P, right, when the vocal tract is closed off, that's where you get silences, in the middle of letters, not at word boundaries. You just have to take my word for that. Until you can actually see the evidence, you'll have to believe me. Our subjective experience of ordinary reading is the same. It's wrong, right? Insofar as if I asked you, what are you doing when you're reading, you would say something like, people do say something like, I'm scanning across the page, picking up the words as I go in a continuous sweep, and then I reset and scan and reset and scan and reset. Of course, the other way around, unless you're reading Hebrew, for you, right? But that's not right. You probably know that's not right intellectually. In fact, what we do is alternate between jumps and pauses. And the jumps are called saccades, and the pauses are called fixations. And it's the same when you're looking at a photograph, and that's where change blindness comes from. You've heard that before, right? But what's interesting is that you miss words out altogether. You don't stop at each word, right? You skip over 2 to 3 words at a time. And again, Frank will give you the details on that on Thursday. There's lots to learn about this. We've only had really good, relatively non-invasive eye trackers. I remember the first eye tracker I ever saw was a real Iron Maiden affair where you had to have your head locked into an iron framework. It was black. It took up about the size of this desk, because it had to be rigid in order to avoid jitter. The modern ones, and it worked by knowing where your head was, so it could know where your eye was, so it could know where you were looking, right? Modern ones work off double reflection and things that I don't understand, but they're much lighter weight, both literally and figuratively. And we've gotten a huge amount of interesting experimental data in the last 20, 25 years, getting more frequent 10 or 15 years ago with the lighter white ones, that gave us and continue to give us all kinds of insight, not only into visual attention, in vision in general, but also particularly about reading. I want to briefly mention something about teaching reading, because some of you may be aware of the extent to which this is an extraordinary political minefield. I don't know, you know, different ones of you, because you came from different countries, will have come up through different generations of the pendulum. As in many other things, there's a pendulum in the teaching of reading that swings back and forth between emphasis on what's on the letter to sound rules, and in the English speaking world, the dominant ideology there goes under the name of phonics. And the other end of the pendulum is something which, although they don't know it, ends up being something that emphasizes the whole word path through the dual root story. And it's, at the moment, I think the dominant sort of version of that is called whole language reading teaching, right? But depending on how old you are, you were taught one way or the other, or by some more or less unfashionable mixture of the two, unless, of course, you had a good teacher who knew better than to believe any of that and just taught you to read, right? So it's a huge, huge industry. There's an enormous amount of money to be made in the teaching of reading. And it would be nice, wouldn't it be nice, if the science actually informed the educational policy? Doesn't work that way. Part of the problem is that, as you could sort of see from what I just said, both the models that are out there can be read as giving ammunition to either side of the debate. Because they both have distinct modules for letter to sound rules, which the phonics people can point to and say, see, see, right? That's what matters. Or the whole word pronunciation, which the whole language people say, that, right, right, that's right, that's right, that's the important bit. We're right. It says so here in this scientific paper. Right. Unfortunately, even people who believe in evidence-based medicine or evidence-based teaching, there are even fewer of those, what little data there is from real evidence outcome-based trials is, as you can imagine if you think about it for a minute, it's really noisy data. It's really hard to do good controls. It's almost impossible to control for teacher quality. After all, if you knew that this teacher was bad, you wouldn't want to put children in their class, would you? So you can't say, right, we're going to get some bad teachers and some good teachers, and we'll put, no, you can't do that, right? And it's even harder to control for home input because people don't tell the truth. Right? However, insofar as we know anything at all, and this is old data, there may be newer data. This is the data that I learned about many years ago, and a friend of mine worked for the National Institute of Education in the U.S., and they funded this enormous trial across huge numbers of schools all over the U.S., and the one thing they found one very strong positive correlation with outcomes, with reading ability, controlled for across intelligence and a bunch of other stuff, right? Can anybody guess what it was? Just think for a second. Don't say it out loud. Just think what you think it might be. And it was the amount by which the child had been read to. You read out loud to a child a lot, it will learn to read well and early, right? Hard to control for socioeconomic class in that, but not impossible. And the findings are pretty robust. So if you ever have kids, read to them. Sentence level processing is the next level at which we might find some interesting information. Eye tracking data give us a bunch of interesting insights there, particularly into what at least some of us think of as the parser, the thing that knows about the grammar of English or the grammar of German or the grammar of Japanese. Now, it's contentious, it's not a given, that there is a parser, that there is a grammar Well, that there is a grammar that linguists study, yes. You can't say that they aren't studying the grammar of English. But it might not have anything to do with how you or I speak or understand English. There's a hypothesis there, which is that something like the grammar that the linguist studies actually plays a role, a causal role, in human language behavior. Stipulate that it does, well, what's the alternative? All we need is word meaning and common sense, right? Isn't that good enough? Well, I've always thought not, right? Consider this famous sentence from 19th century English linguistics, where the focus was on morphology. You can see we've got both derivational and inflectional morphology here. But if we contrast the farmer killed the duckling with the farmer was killed by the duckling with the duckling killed the farmer, well, it's pretty unlikely, but if it ever happened, you have to be able to tell people about it. If all we had was words and common sense, and I came running into you and I said, oh my God, duckling managed to kill the farmer, you wouldn't know what I had said, because you would think, duckling, farmer, kill? Well, it's obvious, the farmer killed the duckling. Right? But that's not what I said, is it? Right? So there's something more going on, it seems to me. And of course, in an inflectional language, you know, you could start making arguments about the by and the, you know, and the word order. Well, but in Russian, it's just inflectional morphology that distinguishes these. Say, lots of languages, that's true. So we need some kind of story about how we stitch things together and what that depends on, right? And what that depends on, we'll call grammar for the sake of argument. And the bit that does the stitching together, we'll call parsing, right? Who did what to whom? Not what was it and who were they, that's semantics. But who was it that did what? You know, which bit is about which bit? How can we probe this? Well, I'm going to do a little experiment on you, and we'll finish, because I put more slides in this talk than I thought I had time for. In case I was wrong about that, because this is a new bit of this course. So what I'm going to do is show you two sentences, one at a time, one word at a time, using what's called RSVP, Rapid Serial Visual Presentation. So it's going to go Rapid Serial Visual Presentation, right? One word replacing another in the middle of the screen. And what I want you to do is get out a bit of, if you don't have paper and pen out, get out paper and pen. Because after each sentence finishes, they go by very quickly. After each sentence finishes, I want you to write down as much of it as you can. And mark where you think you begin to lose it, if you do. If you get the whole thing perfect, fine, just put a mark at the end. But if you feel that you got the first three or four words and then you're not sure what happened next, mark that. Mark the transition from where you were sure to where you're just sort of filling in the bits and pieces. And of course, writing down the last word, because you always remember the last word. Those of you who've done psychology have heard about primacy and recency. If you don't get the first and the last word wrong, you weren't actually looking. Right. First and last word, right. You weren't actually looking, right? So now I'm going to blank the screen to make sure that the thing is ready to go before I put it up, because otherwise I will give the answer away by mistake. Right. Come back. Okay, so you need to pay attention to the middle of the black region. Forget the yellow region. You can see it says My Serial Visual Presentation Applet, not mine, somebody else's. All right. So I got to move the mouse over here to press the start button. Ready, steady, go. Okay, write down as much as you saw. Write down everything you can remember and make a mark where you lost track of it. And don't look at each other's paper. Okay, we're going to do another one. Different sentence, I promise. Everybody finished writing? Mark where you think you went wrong. Okay, here comes another one. Ready, steady, go. Two minutes to finish this off. What was the difference between these two? Well, the first sentence had something funny about it. I hope some of you experienced, at least. Because this is the actual first sentence. And this is an actually occurring newspaper headline, very slightly modified for use in this class. Bethany Lott was killed while being proposed to by a lightning strike in Atlanta. What? No, wait a minute. Bethany Lott was killed while being proposed to by a lightning strike in Atlanta. Right? So maybe you will have marked something somewhere around the by, right, as where you lost track of things. And here's another, the second one is very similar in structure, but I hope didn't cause anywhere near as much trouble. President Kennedy was assassinated while entering Dallas by a lone assassin, a lone gunman, in 1965. So very similar in structure, but doesn't have the same problem with it. One more slide. Garden paths. These are known as garden path sentences, or the first one is. The second one isn't. Right? They give a tantalizing glimpse into sentence-level reading and how the human language parser works. There was a brief interest in the 70s in these sentences because people thought if they could build deterministic parsers, parsers that never changed their minds, they would give some insight into this phenomenon. Here are some classic examples that you will find in the literature. The horse raced past the barn fell. Right? That's the one that you will see most often. Right? I told the girl the cat scratched Bill would help her. I told the girl the cat scratched, Bill would help her. And this is my favorite. The cotton clothing is made of grows in Mississippi. The cotton clothing is made of grows in Mississippi. So the thing I want to leave you with about this is that at least some of these are only liable to garden pathing in their written version. And furthermore, when you see them, because garden paths don't happen very often, but they do happen in reality. And some of you may recognize this when I tell you what I'm, you know, my and other people's experience, which is that you're reading along perfectly comfortably and you suddenly grind to a halt because you've hit the wall at the end of the garden path, as it were. And you back up, and the subjective experience is you hear the sentence again differently. You hear it with the right intonation, the intonation that takes you away from the garden path and into the correct interpretation. So there's some interaction, there's some trading relation between our ability to deal with complex sentences out loud by giving people intonational cues, by depending on the cues that our interlocutors give us. That's the way it works in speech. In writing, we've got punctuation, but punctuation doesn't always do it for us, in which case we've got our ability to back up. We can do something when we're reading that we can't do when we're listening. Right? We can actually run back to the beginning of the sentence and try again. Right? That ability isn't bounded by the length of the sentence, by the length of the echo buffer that you talked about last week, in the way that it is in acoustic processing. If it's out of the echo buffer, you've lost it. You can't back up and listen to it again. But you can always run back your eyes back up the page. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we're a little bit late. We'll have, as I mentioned, please come because he's a very good speaker and works with this stuff at the tip of the arrow, as it were, the cutting edge. Frank Keller will be a guest speaker to talk about eye tracking on Thursday. Sorry?